show, and I'm pleased to have back today Dr. John Turner with his book, Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations, A Doctor's Journey Through the Worlds of Divine Intervention, Near-Death Experiences, and Universal Energy. Dr. Turner is a neurosurgeon, and his book relates not only his personal story, but also stories of his patients, illustrating the strange and wonderful path that we can look forward to as we seek enlightenment. Welcome, Dr. Turner. How are you today?
Oh, hi, Susan. It's great to be talking to you again.
Great. Well, you're in Hawaii, is that right? You're at the Big Island?
I'm on the Big Island in the city called Hilo, which is the second largest city in Hawaii. But actually, it's a small town, maybe 70,000 or less, and somewhat removed in time. I would say maybe 50 years back in time. It's such a quaint and charming city.
I spent some time on the Big Island, actually twice, when I was recovering from an injury I had. And I think the Big Island has a wonderful grounding energy and an area of increased spirituality among the population. And your book reflects that in some of the stories that you tell. The people in the Big Island are more aware of the spiritual aspects of their life, or many of them are.
I think the reason, Susan, when you say grounding, that's literally correct. A volcano, Kilauea volcano, has been erupting daily since, I think, 1983.
Right.
Think new land and just pouring into the sea. So it's quite a high energy place.
So basically, you were guided to this island, and you tell your story. Would you like to share a little bit of that guidance that you had and how things unfolded once you followed that guidance?
Yes, I was looking for a place where my two sons, I think they were like 3 and 5 at the time, could grow up, and they could learn to live without hating anyone. Their mother was Caucasian, and I'm a mixture of all kind of races, but pretty much mostly, probably say, African-American.
Uh-huh.
But I wanted them, they're mixed-looking kids, and I wanted them not to have to go through what I went through in the Midwest.
Right.
And as I searched from New York to California for a job, the job opportunities were great as far as income and the types of neurosurgical cases, but
right.
I didn't find anywhere that I could say, hey, this is a good place for them to grow up and live happily.
Right.
And at the last moment, it was in April 1981, and I had a month left of training or two, and I still didn't have a job located, and I kind of reached up to get my surgical mask one day, and there was a Journal of Neurosurgery, and I just opened it right to an ad.
Uh-huh.
It said, surgeon wanted, Hilo, Hawaii, and the rest was history, so to speak, because when I arrived here, the minute I stepped off the plane and looked at the people, I realized that they all looked like my kids. And
right.
Yeah, so it was perfect for that. I was really guided here because, also, this island had never had a neurosurgeon, so any head trauma had to be flown out, and sometimes that could be a delay of up to 6 hours. So,
and sometimes that could cost the person their life, in especially with certain traumatic injuries.
Yeah, that golden hour may be the same
as
Jeff's plastic surgery because, you have to move quickly on things. So, yes, there was a need here, and I was called by Hawaii, as many people who end up here are called, and I really think that they're being called back home.
They are.
Yeah,
that's really true. I felt a real strong connection with the Big Island. And, it's interesting. We are guided to go where we need to go when we need to go there. And sometimes until afterwards where we're reviewing everything, we don't even realize how important that guidance was for what we had to go through and manifest. And as you say in your book, burn off our karma, which is an interesting term.
That's right. I agree.
So, you related in your book a story about a young man who was in a coma, and he had a traumatic injury, and you did surgery, but he ended up in a coma. And I was intrigued by the story when he visited you in his dream. Would you like to recount that story for our listening audience?
Yes, actually. Now, that particular case was almost one of the early cases, and
right.
It was the first one that really taught me something very important, which I've learned lately after I wrote this book and talked about that story to Robert Moss, who has studied dreams for so long. Some very important message in that case. So let me try to be brief and describe what happened.
Sure.
It was a time when I had come to this island to begin as a neurosurgeon, but they were having a tugboat strike, and all the tools that I had handpicked from the catalogs and the Hilo Medical Group had kindly funded the money to do this for the hospital. They were all on order, but they were stuck somewhere because of this tugboat strike. The barge couldn't
right.
make it to port. So that first night I was on call in August of 1981, I got the call. A young man had flown off his dirt bike right into the guy wire of a telephone pole and cracked his head and had what's called a blood clot on the brain. Technically, it was called a subdural hematoma, but at that time, there was no CAT scan at all on the island. In fact, the first 2 years since I was here, there was no CAT scan.
Well, that means you have to be good at clinical diagnosis.
No, in this particular case, yeah, because there wasn't much time. He had a blown pupil.
Right. Yeah.
That means a dilatation of the pupils, signifying that there perhaps is a traumatic blood clot, and perhaps 80 to 90% of the time that clot is on the side of the pupil. So, based on that, I took him to surgery and found out there were only a couple of instruments. One you're familiar with called a rongeur, which is
right.
a hiding device like a pair of pliers. But they only had a small, narrow rongeur, so it could only take small pieces of bone. And then one drill called a Hudson drill. It looks like an ordinary brace and bit,
right.
but it hadn't been used ever, I think, and it wasn't sharp. Put it like this, I had a hard time.
I bet you did.
Trying to
right.
remove enough to get this blood clot out. Now, normally,
right.
we do something we call turn a flap. We use a power instrument or a giggly saw, which is a wire saw, to, you know, cut between holes and remove a big plate of blown
right.
Well, I couldn't do that. I had to chip away enough just to expose this, get the blood clot out. To make the long story short, I couldn't save the boy. He ended up with tremendous brain swelling because of the time delay and so
right.
forth. And anyway, pupils became both dilated and unresponsive to light. So essentially, and he had no spontaneous respiration, he was essentially brain dead. Well, when this happens, it's really up to the family. I can make the recommendation to discontinue the respiratory support and let him move on, but the family just couldn't make a decision. So I spoke with them a couple of times about it, very nice Hawaiian family, and they said, well, we just are not sure what we want to do in this case. Well, then I had the dream you're talking about. And in the dream, one night, I'm making rounds with the nurse, and as we come to the boy's bedside, the nurse and I are looking at him, and we see two things. First, a tear comes out of his eye, rolls down his cheek. And the second thing, right then, he takes a breath, triggers the respirator.
Yeah.
I woke up from that right away, and I reached over to the phone. I called the ICU, and I said, how is that young man? They said, well, doctor, I'm sorry. There's been absolutely no change. I said, have you taken a breath? They said, no, nothing like that. I was really disappointed. I thought I had a prophetic dream or something. It was so real. And got to the hospital a couple hours later, and I was making rounds with that very same nurse. And as I was telling her the dream, we came to the boy's bedside, and as we looked at him, two things happened. A tear came down his cheek, and suddenly the light went on, and it triggered the respirator, and he took a breath. I said, this is truly amazing, and I thought he had a chance to make it. I've never seen anyone fixed and dilated in that condition with that brainstem injury ever respond. And it turned out that he never took another breath. That was it. So I called the family together. I told them about the dream, and I told them I'm sorry it wasn't to be, and he's still unchanged, and my recommendation is to continue with this. And you know what they said?
Right.
They said, all right, let's do that. We will agree. Let's stop the machine and let him go on.
Uh-huh.
That was kind of an amazing turnaround for them. So he stopped the machine. He was able to move on, and then I got a call from California. His father, who knew about the situation, wanted to fly over to see me and talk to me. And as he sat down in my office that day, he said, listen, doctor, I understand my son visited you. I said, no, I never met him before this injury, so I'm sorry. And he said, I don't mean that. He said, I mean your dream. I said, well, how would you know that? He said, well, the nurses, the family told him, and that's why he flew over. He said, I want to explain to you what we think. We don't see that dream meaning that he was going to improve. It was his way to somehow get through to you so you would continue to try to do what it took to let him move on.
Right.
Well, what I found out from Robert Moss, being on his show at this point, like you, asked me to recount that dream, that experience. He said, Dr. Turner, did you ever know that the Hawaiians call the tear duct the soul pit? I said, no, I've been here a long time. I've never heard that. He said, yes, it's felt that this is the way the soul leaves the body.
Really?
And then it was, that's why the family changed. When the Hawaiian family heard that tear,
yeah,
they said,
oh, that was a sign.
So now, Susan, if you think about the times you and I both have seen people in a coma, perhaps near death, and they have that tear, I always thought it was some type of autonomic reflex.
Right.
But now I'm wondering, do these Hawaiians have it down? I mean, it's always said in their history. So that was the story of this dream contact, which did allow the boy to move on.
Right, right. And I think it's very important to understand that, you know, death is not the end, it's just merely flipping into another dimensional, you know, place where we're supposed to be, and that there is actually a time that is indicated that's fairly specific for when we're to go. And some people go early, through mistakes or through not, you know, following their guidance or through the desire to go early. You know, there's a desire that can overwhelm one. Some of my patients who've died expressed before they died that they wanted to go. And sure enough, they were powerful manifestors, and they manifested, you know, one of them manifested an allergic reaction, then took kind of an overdose of Benadryl and died of, you know, what we call sleep apnea because of the Benadryl. But people do move on based on their desires, especially when they're great creators, and many of my patients are. So, you know, you have a death date, and if you have a death date, there's no point in trying to stay much beyond the death date if your soul is indicating that that's when you need to go. It's kind of like you're late for an appointment, and that's not good.
Well, you know, Tom Campbell, you know, the nuclear physicist who studied consciousness for over 30-some years, and author of the book My Big Toe, Toe Meaning Theory of Everything, says that there's a shift in the reality frame. That when someone dies, they enter a special frame of reality designed for those making the new transition. And they often need help because there's a considerable confusion, especially if they've never thought about death and dying.
Right.
And
yeah,
yesterday,
true.
A friend came over, wanted to watch a movie, and I said, look, I have a great one for you. This movie, Passengers.
Oh, yeah. I am. It's good.
And so that does exemplify exactly what we're talking about.
Right.
And I think it's the knowing of death that allows us to move on. And sometimes it can be speedy if we know what to expect. But if we don't, there is this period of confusion, and people can be stuck for a while. They need help. So, yes, exactly what you say is correct.
So how does this – I guess in medicine we're taught to, you know, to save the patient at all costs and to – you know, do whatever we need to do to preserve life. And certainly that's good advice in ordinary reality. But there are times that, you know, where we know that the patient is probably not going to make it based on the injuries. And I think sometimes we just help the person through the transition. This is what I'm told. I had an experience where I got called to the emergency room, level 2 trauma center here in town, and as I was pulling out of the driveway, I heard that the patient wasn't going to make it. And I said, well, you know, should I still go down there? And the answer is yes, because you're going to help. And I went down there. It was a pedestrian MVA. That means that a car had hit the patient and amputated one of his legs and had multiple fractures. And I was there for facial lacerations and facial fractures. And as I watched them work on him, because he was critical, I spoke with him in my mind. You know, I just was, he was there, and he started asking me questions. He said, should I go back in my body? how long will it take me to recover? And I said, probably about a year, you know, just based on my knowledge of trauma. And we had this discussion, and he was up in the corner of the room. I could sense his presence up there. And I hadn't met him before. I mean, I just walked in the room and was just there. And then he said, well, I think I'm going to go. I think I do not want to go back in the body. And then he left, and at the minute he left, he went flatlined on the monitors. And that was an interesting experience.
Well, I can comment on that, something really interesting. My friend Johnny Lerma, author of Into the Light and Learning from the Light, discussed with me what it might mean when patients report commonly being up in the corner of the room.
Yeah, and they said, are.
If you think about the shape of the typical corner, it's like a tetrahedron. And if you think about the Great Pyramid, for example, which was like a stargate of some type, and apparently there's some water flowing currents under that pyramid that act as a vortex and produce a torsion type of energy, there may be a reason for appearing in the corner first and observing everything before moving on. Yeah, that's kind of interesting. So that was a great experience you had. And so anyway, there may be something to the corner, the cornerstone or something.
Yeah, it's very interesting. That, but I do believe from experiences like this and others that although we have some choice, he did have a choice. I think he had a choice to come back in the body, and whether he'd be there for minutes, hours, days, or weeks, I don't know. Or if he could have re-inhabited that body, you know, in other words, his spirit and soul come back in and re-inhabit that body and heal it. You know, many things are possible. But again, I do believe that we have a death date, and that sometimes that death date is final. And that when it's time to move on, what we should do as physicians and nurses and other healthcare providers is provide support and energy to help with that transition.
Exactly.
And I think we can.
That healing, healing doesn't always mean a cure. It can be a spiritual healing, emotional healing. So that's a good case to exemplify that.
Yeah. And I think that in general, I've been guided to witness many of these transitions, not only when people are deciding whether or not to leave the body, but also energy coming back in the body in order to provide organ transplantation opportunities, which happened in another ER. I was in the ER in maximal effort, and I was guided to go over to the room because I was supposed to see something. I was like, go over there because we want to show you something. And what I saw is they've been working on this child for, I don't know, over an hour. And the minute the light hit the brain, because there was an energy going to the heart and then an energy going to the brain, the minute the energy hit the heart, the monitor showed a pulse and heart rate. In this particular child, there was no energy going to the brain. But I saw a beam going to the heart, and then immediately the ER doctor, who was a friend of mine, said, we have a pulse and heart rate, and we're going to transfer to the children's hospital. And then later on that evening, I went to the children's hospital to see another patient, and I talked with the doctor who received this patient. And he had he's spiritually based and has some spiritual insights. And he said, well, I don't think the child was resuscitated in terms of having a heart and blood pressure to recover, but to be an organ donor. And sure enough, that's what happened, ended up happening.
You had plastic surgery, Bill?
You bet I did. I got tired of the wrinkles around my eyes and decided to have Plasticos do something about them.
But I didn't think men had plastic surgery.
Get with it, Bob. Men want to look their best, too. There's nothing wrong with getting a little help from Plasticos to look on top of your game. A lot of guys are doing it, my friend.
Well, I don't know about this.
Look, you see the difference Plasticos made with me. I look better and I feel better. My Plasticos surgery was an investment in me.
So where is Plasticos?
Plasticos is in Dunwoody. Plasticos is staffed by pros who guarantee you personal attention. The Plasticos number is 770-457-4677. Mention this ad for a free consultation. Financing is available. 770-457-4677.
So you had plastic surgery. What was it like?
It was great. Don't get me wrong. It was surgery, but the doctors and staff at Plasticos were terrific.
Honey, you look like $1 million. You actually went to Plasticos and had it done.
Why don't you? Plastic surgery is outpatient, and you'll only be out of work a few days. I love what Plasticos did for me, and looking my best is an investment that pays in so many ways. The help you get from the professionals at Plasticos is a bargain.
Plasticos, 770-457-4677. Mention this ad for a free consultation. Financing is available. 770-457-4677.
Well, welcome back. We had a short break due to some technical issues, and I hope we have better sound now. I'm interviewing Dr. John Turner. He's the author of Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations, and we've been talking about the doctor's journey through worlds of divine intervention, near-death experiences, and universal energy. Some of the things that we've both learned through our journey as surgeons are that, you know, we are guided in certain ways to help people, and what we were talking about before is that we're not always guided to save their lives, although sometimes that does happen. But sometimes we're guided to help people through transition and help families through the transition of loved ones and provide the energy and the insight to know where the guidance needs to come from. And so that's it's a little bit of a turn on the traditional view that you save life at all costs and spend money to no end. And I believe that a lot of the healthcare crisis, which is, you know, where a lot of money is spent both in the beginning of life and at the end of life, could be saved if we had some spiritual information about what was the best course for the patient.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking when you're talking about that, you can hear me okay now, Susan.
I can, yeah.
All right. When was it, if you think about pre-med, medical school, residency, and then working after that, when was it that you realized, yeah, this is the things that we have to consider? I mean, if you think about traditional medical education as it probably still exists in the United States, we're not getting that kind of insight and training until we're out on the job. Do you remember when it happened for you?
Well, you know, even when I was about 5 years old, I would have a knowing that someone was going to die. And I didn't know how I knew that, but, you know, sometimes they weren't old or weren't sick, and I would express the fact that they were going to die, and then they did. So I think with the information I had from the spiritual world combined with the information I was learning in medical school and residency, I had to bring the two worlds together. And I think the time I did that was when I was working at a level one trauma center in Wilfred Hall Medical Center, because we saw a lot of people come in and die. You know, you're familiar with level one trauma centers. There was a saying with the EMTs, Wilfred Hall or not at all. In other words, anybody that wasn't going to make it up the road to Bexar County was brought to us. And we were between the bad side of town and Bexar County, which was the other level one trauma center in San Antonio. So we saw a lot of death. And I would just watch. I would just watch things happen. I had a team with me that was, had been medics in Vietnam, and they were fabulous. We could get somebody from the ER door to where we were making an incision within 20 minutes. I mean, we just had a great ER. And I would just watch, and then I would listen to my own inner guidance, and I would know if somebody had a pneumothorax. I would know if they had an epidural hematoma. But the most important thing for me was to remain quiet and calm and able to receive information in that emergency room and also later in the operating room.
Were you able to share this with the other physicians that you had this ability?
I don't remember sharing it. I remember thinking that some of them had it too. You know, some, I mean, doctors are guided into to being, especially trauma surgeons and ER and people who deal with life and death situations frequently. Some anesthesiologists you've known, I'm sure, are like that. How do they know what they know? You know, they just know. And they don't have to spend a lot of time with diagnostic tests. They just, I mean, all of a sudden they'll just know somebody through an embolus. How do they know that? You know, it's like, and they're right. You know, it's like,
yeah, maybe it's a
clinical experience, but no, it's probably intuition.
Yeah, I think it's a way of quieting the mind enough to let the information that's always there
right.
get through. Definitely.
And people who are egotistical and self-centered, and it's always about them, which is, you know, a fair number of surgeons, including neurosurgeons and plastic surgeons, they block that information through the, you know, through how they're processing energy, I think.
Yes,
and so
true.
You want anesthesiologists and surgeons and other healthcare providers who are calm and tuned into whatever information is coming in through the you know, through whatever means. I mean, I want my doctors to not only be intuitive but also very intelligent. You know?
Well, it's interesting. I, you know, just before you called, I had a book in my hand called Matrix Energetics by Dr. Richard Bartlett.
Right.
Who, by the way, will be speaking at next year's ISSSEEM conference. And I turned to a page at random. I said, let me see what I can find just before Susan calls. And it was an example where he's talking about that old movie, you know, about Luke Skywalker and the Force.
Right.
And how that when he was able to calm his mind, he was able to do all of these things. And he relates that to his training before in martial arts, you know, where he had to be aware that the instructor was coming up from behind to strike with a sword. And it's a matter of just letting that information, which is there for all of us all the time, to let it come through. And that's what you've been able to do, which, you know, I allowed you for that. That's really great.
Well, there is a mastery to obtain in not just surgery or medicine or teaching or whatever vocation that you decide to do, but there's a mastery over, I would say, the manifested realities, understanding how they work, understanding how we fit in with all that is, you know, because that's interesting too. You know, what effect do we really have on the whole? What effect does our consciousness have on the whole consciousness?
Yeah, there you go. In fact, that's what I think it is. I think one goal is to understand consciousness, you know, and when we reach a level through this life as we're starting to realize this is what we have to do, then things really start to change. We really start to get to the meat of why we're here, what goal we have to accomplish. And Richard Bach put it very well, you know, in one of his writings, he said, if you want to know if your mission on Earth has been accomplished, if you're reading these words, then you're not finished.
It hasn't yet, because you're still here.
That's
right. So true.
But I think also the way to go through this properly, we've got to always be not thinking of ourselves, but also be willing to help other people at any time and often without their having to ask for it. Because once we stop that and the selfishness kind of creeps in, that may be that our job is kind of finished and we haven't really accomplished the lessons where we can do it and take advantage of learning these lessons. So that data moving on, maybe it's fixed, as you say, but maybe it can be changed a little bit the more aware we are of why we're here and what we need to do.
I think the key is following your guidance. There are many choices out there, and you know, you can... I believe what happens to you along the path is not so much up to you, but how you respond to it is variable. In other words, when you are faced with a great challenge, you know, do you curse the gods? Do you blame your coworkers or other people? Do you do this? Do you do that? Do you cycle down into negativity? Or do you actually become quiet and ask to find the way out of the quagmire you're in, or asked to find the information about why this manifested in your life and what lessons you have to learn. And then, you know, as many movies and books books have showed us that sometimes our greatest challenges are actually our greatest blessings. And, you know, that theme that really, and a lot of people with cancer say that this is the best thing that ever happened to them. So, you know, we manifest, first of all, you have to take responsibility. You manifest in your life what you're manifesting in order to grow spiritually. And if you're a victim, then you block that path off. You're not going to grow spiritually. You're just going to remain a victim. And I think if you keep failing the test and failing the test and failing the test, I think eventually one way out is through death. And then the other thing, like you said before, when you've actually mastered everything you're supposed to do, the exit is death too. So death has two different meanings. Sometimes it's your graduation, and sometimes it's the fact that you just didn't, you're not getting it, and your body is now so racked with problems that it can't heal itself, or, you know, so you got to go and get a new body, you know.
May I insert a quick plug here?
Sure.
Now, can you hear me okay, Susan? It's raining outside.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Hilo is the rainiest city in the United States.
Is it really?
So we have a nice, gentle rain this morning. I hope it's not bothersome. But the plug is for Epictetus, the great Greek philosopher who, around 53 A.D., has a one three-part quote that fits in exactly with what you're saying. And it begins by saying, to blame others for one's misfortune is a sign of a want of education. The second part says, to blame oneself for one's misfortunes is a sign that education is in progress. But the third part is the key, to blame neither others nor oneself, it's a sign that education is complete. And I think when we can reach that point, I mean, I've been trying hard to do it, and I'm getting close. I think that then allows us to move on because we've experienced and we understand then forgiveness at that point, and that there is really no one to blame. And I think you're quite right. We may not be able to change these learning experiences that are planned for us, but we do have some control over how we're going to react to them. And are we going to be seek retribution and blame others for things, or are we going to feel guilty, blame ourselves, and all that? And but I think when we realize, look, that's the way it works, we can move on. That's my thought.
I think so too. There's two things that come to mind. One is the information at the beginning of the Course in Miracles, which says the curriculum is the same. The time you take to take the curriculum is up to you. So you can go very quickly. So somebody who has a lot of misfortune in their life may not just have bad karma. They actually may choose to take the curriculum very quickly. And then the other thing is the poem by Kipling. And I actually go back and read that fairly often, because I feel that is the path of the initiate, with the initiate being the person who is aware of consciousness and aware of this path that we're on, but not yet a master. And Kipling's poem goes through and says all of the tests the initiate is going to take. You know, can you lose everything on a toss and not worry about it and yet recreate everything? Can you walk, you know, can you be falsely accused and have it not bother you? Can you, you know, walk with kings or poor people and not see the difference, you know, not feel special because you're with kings? And it just goes through, and every single test on there is the curriculum, as far as I
know.
What
poem is that, Susan? I need to look at that one.
Kipling's poem, it was, You'll Be a Man, My Son. If you do all of this, you'll be a man, my son. So, let's see. Kipling.
I'll look at that for sure. That summarizes everything.
Yeah, it really does. I had it, I got it in a, as a present one time. Somebody gave it to me, you know, in a nice little frame thing. And let's see if I can, here it is. I'll read it. I'm looking on the internet. So, let's see. Here it is. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you. Now, you and I have both been in that situation as surgeons. If you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too. If you can wait and not be tired by waiting, and what surgeon isn't learning patience, right? Or be lied about and don't deal in lies. Or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them up with worn-out tools, if you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss, and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they're gone, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and which is more, you'll be a man, my son.
Wow, that's truly excellent.
Isn't that great?
Yes, I remember little parts of that. Yes, that is excellent. I wonder
how
those words came to a guy like that.
Yeah, well, I believe we are in a curriculum, and a lot of it includes false accusation. A lot of it includes being, you know, having gratitude despite having, you know, everything thrown at you, having your words twisted, having your intents misinterpreted. So everything that comes to me, I kind of just look and listen and observe it rather than immediately judge it. And I think, you know, because I really feel that we do need to not go to the negative, you know, just as a matter of course, even when it looks like, you know, we're being victimized or we're being, whatever. I mean, I think this is all just part of the curriculum.
Yeah, how would it be if everyone, or most of us, were on that kind of a level where we saw things that way? Wouldn't it be a different world?
It would be. So much violence and anger and hatred in the world is from perceived victims. You know, they're lashing out against those they perceive that are victimizing them. And so it becomes an endless cycle, but I think that the energies that are coming with this future galactic alignment are going to be less favorable to that kind of energy management. So I think that people who do that will find themselves manifesting negative quicker and quicker, and probably, you know, not being able to stay and continue to manifest in the negative.
Let me say this, Susan. Your show, Temple of Health, I've found is a very metaphysical show. You would agree, right?
Yeah, I think it is.
Because when I first heard about this, you know, months ago, to be on your show, I thought we'd be discussing only medical things, and I couldn't quite figure before I met you, was it going to be plastic surgery, general surgery, what we're going to be
right.
talking about. But you remember our last conversation. I don't know if that we've ever had a chance to listen to that again, but I can't remember exactly what we talked about. It was like, as I mentioned to you after, it was like I was sitting down talking with my sister about things we always talk about, right?
Right, yeah.
And we got into a lot. We probably discussed forgiveness a little bit, right? And the fact that you need, it seems like going through the fire and the trials and tribulation are what forges us into a higher state of consciousness, gives us the boost. So with that in mind, I want to ask you a question now, if you don't mind.
Sure.
What is your feeling about the, are you familiar, of course you are, with the Norway lights and that event? What is your personal feeling about that, your impression you have from what happened that night before President Obama received the Peace Prize?
Well, I've had two different things that I've read, and they're interesting. One is that harp, there was a Norway harp that was evidently active at the time. And so the question is, was that the result of harp? And then the other was a question of whether it was related to some ET activity, actually being energy coming in from outside the planet.
So you didn't buy anything at all about a Russian missile shot going awry?
The Russian missile shot going awry was in the information about the ET. that perhaps it was ET influence that caused the missile to go awry.
You know,
but I don't know for sure. I mean, I just read those on the internet.
I'll tell you, a great discussion on that was by William Henry.
Uh-huh.
And,
yeah,
you know,
I know
I'm really interested in William's theory on stargates, you know, such as the Capitol building in D.C., such as the Great Pyramid, and things
right.
that maybe allow us to boost to a higher consciousness. Now, while I got your attention on this, let me ask you this. In your training, you recall saying that an AP, anterior posterior skull film, we can measure the pineal shift.
Uh-huh.
This was way back before CAT scans. You probably don't remember these days, right?
Yeah,
but I remember
true.
That. And,
I did
but
too.
You know what? Never did anyone teach us or teach me why in adults that gland calcifies.
That's true.
And I'm finding now it can be related to fluoride and that fluoride in the drinking water.
Yep.
And the question is, if indeed Dr. Rick Strassman's theory of DMT, dimethyltryptamine, being produced by the pineal is correct, this does somehow have to do with our ability to access these higher levels of consciousness. And could it be that there is some plan to keep us as sheep and keep us from expanding our consciousness? What do you think about that, Susan?
Oh, I think that there's a definite concerted effort, not just with the fluoride in the water, but also with the electromagnetic, you know, things involving cell towers, cell phones, the new energies coming through direct TVs, you know, or the digitized TVs. There's many, many theories about how to keep the population docile and unable to access higher consciousness. Now, whether or not that actually was planned or whether it just occurred as a matter of technology development, I really don't know. I mean, I don't have proof one way or the other, but I know there are things that you can do to decrease your exposure to these things. There are other things that, in fact, the Army has done, or the military has done some things to decrease electromagnetic exposures inside the helmets of their troops. And so that anything that is put out with technology that might be decreasing your ability to raise your consciousness, there are tools to counter it. So I think people need to do their own research.
Maybe all the people at UFO events wearing tinfoil helmets are not far off the mark.
Yeah, really. There are a lot of energetic challenges that we have now that we didn't have 50 years ago. Now, is this the cause of all these strange, you know, illnesses and immune problems that we have now? I don't know. There's theories that there's all sorts of chemical things put out, electromagnetic, like you said, the fluoride in the water might calcify the pineal gland. These are all theories that are out there. But the question is, what was the intent? Was the intent to do this? If so, then the planet is most likely controlled by dark force energy. I mean, you know, that would be my conclusion. But, you know, it's hard to know.
You know, hard to say. My point about the Stargate thing and the Norway lights is that it's kind of strange what we're told about a Russian missile of, I don't know, 18 times has gone funny and spiraled like that. And then you'd wonder, as William Henry has put it, why would anyone allow a missile shot when the President of the United States is going to be in that vicinity? I mean, in Norway, they welded shut 400-some manhole covers, right?
Uh-huh.
They had an anti-ballistic kind of tank position to shoot down any incoming kind of missile type of thing. So they had plenty of precautions for that visit. So that whole missile thing doesn't sound right. Something very strange happened. And could it be that Project HAARP was doing something like that? Well, who knows what the truth is. And since I think, Susan, all of this, meaning our conversation, our day-to-day waking life, is like a dream, and most likely is a dream, it certainly is an interesting time to be alive, isn't it?
It is, and there's one thing we heard in session that I think is worth, you know, putting out there for our listening audience. And you know, you can believe this or you cannot believe it. It came through clairvoyant information, if you want to. But essentially, not everything you see is real. There are holographic means to project things that seem real. I mean, it's kind of like, you remember CNN when they had the election, they projected the person that they were talking to. Well, evidently, technology exists that is even more sophisticated than what you saw on CNN. And so things can be projected into third-dimensional reality that would seem like they're real, but in actuality, they're no more real than the Passion of the Christ actually depicting that Jesus was crucified. You know, in other words, it's a movie. So if it is possible to have three-dimensional movies play out in three dimension, you just have to ask yourself whenever you see something, well, is that real? And so one of the things I thought with the spiral over Norway, are they testing the system? You know, is this just a test of the holographic system to see if everybody would see the spiral? And then, of course, like, the missile thing was a disinformation, if that was true. But I don't know. Or was it really a missile that was shot down by forces that are outside of, you know, not human and outside of this third-dimensional reality we live in that didn't want a missile to be successful, you know, or
well, it's like you mentioned Course in Miracles. I remember that very first lesson was none of this is real.
Yeah, exactly. It is. It's good. It's good to remember that.
It is true because none of this is real. But I tell you, while we're here in the dream, I think we can make it a good one, or we can make it a bad one if we choose to react to these events in the proper manner.
Yeah,
maybe the choice we have.
Yeah, I would like to recommend that everybody who has cable or satellite take a look at Conspiracy Theory on True TV. I've been quite amused by Jesse Ventura's information. His first one was on HARP. I learned a great deal about HARP. The second one was on 9/11, and his third one was on the global warming scam. And I think next week he's doing all the things that the government can do to watch you, you know, the cameras and the cell phone listening in and this, that, and the other. So that's something that that is available to everybody to watch. And we do live in the world where we need to know things. We shouldn't become paranoid with thinking everybody's watching us, of course. But information is important right now.
Yes. Yes, I agree, and I'll have to look for that True TV Conspiracy Theory.
Yeah, it comes on Wednesday evenings and then replays on Saturdays. But you know, Jesse was a governor and I think he was a wrestler and a he was also a Navy SEAL, so he has military background too. And he has an interesting take on things that is entertaining as well as educational. And, you know, who knows if everything is true? You know, I don't know that everything he doesn't present it as truth. He presents it as information, which is good. It's information is always good.
Yeah, I'm going to look for that show.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. I've enjoyed that. But I think in the next few years, we're going to see a lot more things that are unexplained, or maybe the explanations that are coming through official sources are not quite accurate, and so I think we need to understand that there may be, shall we say, more than appears to be. In other words, there's fourth and fifth dimensional aspects out there that have an effect on the third dimension, and that we're not just alone in the third dimension, that we're, the third dimension is all that is. And crop circles being, you know, an example of that, and I'm sure your investigation into John of God and many of the other phenomena out there would indicate that this statement's true.
Well, exactly, and I wonder, though, is it any different than it was a generation or two ago when sudden things were happening, you know, radio was being developed, then came television, and it seemed like a fantastic thing, or are we really on some sort of asymptotic type of thing where things are really accelerating at a rate that's almost out of our control, so much information, and the rate at which is increasing. And maybe we've got to get back to the old-time ways where we don't have all this high technology to lead us up and up and up and up, because we're losing touch with that with that force or whatever you call it, right? So
well,
I don't know.
Yeah.
There's a simpler way, and to me, that's the island of Molokai, one of the Hawaiian islands, where it's just the opposite of New York City.
Uh-huh.
Everything is quiet, and you can walk 3 miles on the beach and not see another person. I mean, that's, you know, when the mind really can quiet down when you're not bombarded with all this information.
And also, the energy in Hawaii is really conducive to communicating with the spirit world. That's why so much spiritual development has occurred on the islands. People who normally don't have spiritual hearing go to Hawaii, and they can develop it very quickly.
Well, look what happened to you, Susan, with your shoulder, was it, on the beach?
Right,
and
yeah.
Any type of thing. I mean, maybe that could have happened on a street corner in Atlanta, but I think being in Hawaii allowed that.
No, I think it was Hawaii. I think it's that energy down there that is, it to me, because I'm sensitive to energy, I felt it immediately after getting off the airplane as well. It's very grounding. I felt very, very safe there. I felt very tuned in there.
I guess the big question, Susan, is why are you not here now?
Because of my guidance. I am supposed to be in Atlanta. That's where the center is supposed to be. I hope to get back to Hawaii, though. I mean, I hope I can come visit you there and have some relaxation time eventually. I've just published a new book called The Naked Truth About Breast Implants, so, you know, I'll probably be out on a book tour, and maybe, who knows, maybe I'll come to Hawaii on a book tour.
Well, that would be great.
Yeah.
As you know, that word aloha not only means hello and goodbye, but there's a very deep connection with the power of love with that one word, aloha.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why things happen here. And just think, I've been getting a daily dose of this kind of power ever since July 4th of 1981.
Well, that's wonderful. And I'm sure it's helped you a great deal in terms of your personal, you know, path that you've been on, which if you think about, you know, what has transpired since then, you've come a long way.
Well, I just want to say this quickly. Hilo, that word Hilo, this city,
uh-huh.
in Hawaiian means to twist.
Right.
In Japanese, it could mean swirling vortex of fire.
Uh-huh.
And I can look back on things, and I have to tell you, I was twisted and put through the fire in order to come to a realization that it's more than the fact we're all brothers and sisters. It's deeper. It's the fact that we're all one.
Right.
And that thing has been going around a long time. But to come to that realization is a really changing experience.
Yeah, it's once you realize that consciousness is all, then you do react differently. You do, you can become more patient. You can become more developing qualities such as unconditional love. And of course, you become more responsible because you realize that every action and reaction that you have affects the whole. So I think that it becomes easier. The path becomes easier once you step into that awareness. And then eventually that awareness and other similar things lead you to the state of what you would call enlightenment, which is where I think we're all headed. I think that's the energetic alignment that's occurring that is really a galactic alignment. It's not just local law, it's cosmic law, as they say. And I think the Earth will be, subject to different energies. Higher energies that will help all of us have it easier. I think the great polarity between good and evil is going to come down, you know, to something less polarized, which will be a lot easier to live in.
I think you're right. Like the Buddhists would say, you know, that fourth of the noble truths, the four noble truths, is that there is this enlightenment or nirvana or whatever that we can obtain. So maybe this 2012 is a signal that not the end of the world so much, but the fact it might be the end of this old way of thinking and hatefulness and selfishness and a waking up. That's what I think.
Right. Well, would you like to give your website? We're about through with the hour. Your contact information?
It looks like we just got started. But
I know.
The website is simple. It's johnlturner.com. And on there, they can find chapter one of this book that they can read and see if they something they're interested in.
Right.
So they can do a search feature for chapter one or look through the blogs and they'll see it. And then that explains another case in the power of prayer, which is something I had to learn that might be interesting to your listeners. So johnlturner.com.
Uh-huh. Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. We've been talking with Dr. John Turner, the author of Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations. Next week, we will be talking with Dr. William Norquist. The Stealth Killer is Oral Spirochetosis, the Missing Link in Dental and Heart Disease Labyrinth. And then in January, on the 2nd, we will be interviewing Dr. Deborah Smith, Healthcare Resolved, Real Answers, No Politics. And on the 9th, Linda Howe, How to Read the Akashic Records, Assessing the Archive of the Soul and Its Journey. And on the 16th, Dr. Benor, Personal Spirituality, Science, Spirit, and Eternal Soul. For our the rest of January's events and radio shows, please go to our website, www.plasticos.com or templeofhealth.ws. The Noetic Science meeting in January is going to be very interesting. It's on Thursday, January the 21st at the Dunwoody Center. Victor Clark is joining us again for handwriting analysis. And he was with us about 10 years ago in Noetic Science, and I still use his techniques during interviews. The people we interview are amazed that I can tell them so much about themselves by analyzing their handwriting. It's fun, and it's actually very useful if you're running a business. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please be sure to check out Dr. Turner's website, and please go ahead and read his book, Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations. It's a great story. Thank you for joining us, Jack. I'll talk to you later.
Thank you, Susan. Have a nice day.
Bye-bye.